Good morning, everyone. The first argued case this morning is number 17-1131, Vernex against Apple Incorporated. Mr. Zinoviev. Proceed.
Your Honor, and may it please the Court. The Patent Trial and Appeal Board's decisions below should be reversed for at least three reasons. First, the Board improperly assumed the publication date of a reference in the absence of requisite evidence. Second, the Board inexplicably switched its initial inherency theory with a new theory lacking evidentiary support.
But on the publication issue, maybe we can dispose of that. Didn't the burden shift to come forward with a date explicitly written on the record?
Your Honor,
whose burden is it?
Your Honor, we think that actually that on the dynamic drinkware, and we think that on the In Re Magnum, the burden remains on the patent challenger to introduce evidence that the printed publication was publicly available on a certain date. So our position is, as we said particularly in the reply brief, that the burden never shifted to Vernetics.
Well, it said right on its face what the date was, and there was another publication that showed the procedure whereby this organization produces its documents.
Your Honor, the RFC 2041 says nothing as to what the date refers to, whether it's initial draft or whether it's a final version. The process document, RFC 2026, says nothing about the date on the cover of an RFC. The only reference in 2026 to a date is to a copyright date. But this court held that copyright date.
Well, it was more than the copyright date. The top said November 1998. It also said distribution for this memo is unlimited.
Yes, but Your Honor, but that statement addresses the scope of the distribution. So once actually that document is publicly released on a particular date, indeed it will be distributed without limitation. It doesn't address the question of when it was publicly available. So there is no evidence, no competent evidence that was introduced what exactly that date in fact means.
But isn't it prima facie evidence which shifted the burden to show that it was not available?
Your Honor, we don't think that it even rises to the level of a prima facie evidence. We think that the prima facie evidence has to be something strong. It has to be some corroborating evidence as to what that particular date is. And the only evidence that Apple introduced and that the board considered was the evidence of its expert.
So if I buy today's New York Times and it has a date on it that I still have to show something or other 10 or 20 years later?
No, Your Honor, I think with the New York Times you will have the actual publication. But if you introduce just a printout with a particular day and no evidence as to what is the practice of the organization with respect to that date, I mean, with New York Times there is at least historical practice that the date appears on the cover, underneath the logo. With respect to the RFC, again, our contention is there was no evidence as to what is the practice of the organization with respect to the date. And that's exactly the requirements that this court has enforced. It enforced it in Rehol, in Realista, in SRI International, that you need to introduce competent evidence of the organization's practice.
Okay, so we interrupted you. Let's go on to your other points.
Yeah, and I will just one more point on the print publication to finish
okay.
The thought. Indeed, we do agree that Apple tried to introduce evidence that potentially could establish such practice. It tried to introduce the declaration by the RFC editor's representatives. We challenged, and we think that we have a good basis that evidence was inadmissible and also not probative. But even as this court thinks that there may be some other evidence that could establish the practice organization, the proper course is really to remand to the board so that the board can actually properly assess that evidence.
Okay.
But turning to the second issue relates to the proceedings based on Bezzer. And in those proceedings, the board committed two errors. First, at Apple's urgings, the board initially invoked an inherency theory to find that Bezzer discloses the claimed broadband limitation. And it relied on the testimony of Apple's expert that the cable in the modem in Bezzer can transmit modulated signals.
Counsel, you're arguing the obviousness rejection. I assume you're familiar with patent practice. There's a duty of disclosure, which requires an applicant to disclose references material to the patentability of the invention. There are 70 columns of references cited here, which shows that it's a very crowded field. The applicants obviously, presumably felt, if they were acting properly, that all of these references were material to the patentability of the invention. Why isn't it very clear then that these claims are very obvious?
With respect to BASA, we only actually, our appeal is limited to just four claims. And these concern two limitations. They concern the broadband limitation.
But I'm talking about the citation of 70 columns of references, which looks like the applicants were trying to obscure the nature of the prior art and not comply with the duty of disclosure.
Your Honor, we don't think that that was the case at all. And actually what we...
Why were 70 columns of references cited?
Your Honor, I can't...
That doesn't help the examiner.
Your Honor, but I think the examiner, but we... The evidence that was submitted to the examiner was the evidence that we believe the examiner had to have. Mm-hmm. And if you also look at the Avantail, I mean, the examiner initially rejected some of the claims. We submitted clear, what we argue is clear disclosure. The examiner then allowed the claims. So I think that was a typical patent process that was going on in this case. But just, Yuan, if I may turn just to focus the court's attention on these two limitations. With respect to the broadband limitation, the board initially adopted the inherency theory because there was no testimony, no expert testimony that BASA expressly discloses the separate channels in the modulated transmission link. And that was a necessary element of a claimed broadband limitation. There is no dispute about it, and the board's decision mentions that. In the final decision, however, the board asserted that inherency was not necessary to find obviousness, and the board therefore not only impermissibly switched the obviousness theories, but that second obviousness finding is also completely unsupported by evidence, because you had to have expert evidence that that Bezer also disclosed separate channels. On the second point on Bezer concerns the board's finding that just because the originating device in Bezer can be a web TV or multimedia device that's capable of connecting to a server, that necessarily means that the terminating device in BASA also must be a server. The only evidence that the board on which the board relied was evidence by Apple's expert, who testified that the web TV device could be used to connect to a server. But that evidence cannot support the finding that the web TV necessarily would so connect, and therefore cannot support the inherency finding that the terminating device in VS was disclosed as a server. Turning to the third issue that we want the court to address, the third issue is the direct requirement in Avantail. And in the proceedings based on Avantail, the board impermissibly disregarded Vernetix's prior prosecution history disclaimer when construing three related patent terms. During the prosecution of a related patent, Vernetix disclaimed non-direct communications that were disclosed in Avantail, the very same reference that is at issue here. The PTO in that proceeding allowed claims as a result of that disclaimer. Apple itself then described that disclaimer in a district court proceeding as unambiguous, as a clear mandate to the patent office.
But they provided an alternative argument, did they not, accepting the disclaimer?
Your Honor,
was that not for that reference?
Your Honor, if you're referring to Vernetix, there were several arguments that Vernetix provided in the district court. In the district court, Vernetix in fact challenged whether or not that disclaimer should be enforced. Vernetix lost at that point. So the district court's opinion, both Apple's brief, its description of a disclaimer as unambiguous is very clear, and I can provide citations for the court. That's actually on Appendix 23, 995, and 96. And the district court, in its opinion, enforced disclaimer finding that the disclaimer with direct connection in Avantail was clear and unambiguous.
Yeah.
The test, Your Honor, the test for when disclaimer is unambiguous is whether a patent owner's competitors would believe and would view the disclaimer as unambiguous. There can be no stronger evidence of a clarity with disclaimer than the fact that Apple itself, in a proceeding against Vernetix, described the disclaimer as unambiguous and successfully enforced it. The board's main reason for actually rejecting the disclaimer is because purportedly, the board said that Vernetics purportedly could not define what this was meant by the direct communication. That is, first of all, incorrect, because Vernetics explained to the board that the construction referred to direct addressability. And importantly, Vernetics' expert testified that because the communication path in Avantail is relayed for the SUX server, the Avantail server, one of ordinary skill in the art would understand that this is not a direct connection between the client device and the remote host. So there was explanation what direct meant. There was supporting expert evidence. And actually, this court in Cisco, although it didn't have reason to construe ab initio, the claim term direct communication, it certainly applied the district court's construction of direct, and it had no trouble understanding what that particular term meant. And in any event, even if there is some doubt about the precise definition of direct, what Vernetics disclaimed here was precisely the type of a non-direct communication that is disclosed in Avantail. Therefore, at the minimum, Vernetics' disclaimer extended to the scope of Avantail. And for that reason, the board's conclusion that then the board's resulting conclusion that even irrespective of the proper claim construction, Avantail disclosed direct communication just makes no sense. So this court should correct the board's construction of a direct communication and should then reverse the findings, the board's findings that Avantail in fact disclosed the direct communication. Johan, unless there are questions, I will.
Okay, good. Thank you. We'll save the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Quinn.
Thank you, Judge Newman, and may it please the court, John O'Quinn on behalf of Apple. As my colleague noted, I think the principal issue in these IPR appeals is whether the board was entitled to find as a factual matter that RFC 2401 was publicly accessible prior to the critical date where Apple introduced evidence relating to the RFC practices, but Vernetics presented no evidence whatsoever that it was not publicly available or accessible as of the date on the face of the document. That issue, of course, is dispositive as to three of the five patents at issue in this proceeding and all but six of the claims of the remaining two patents. And because those six remaining claims add obvious limitations that are suggested in the Beezer reference itself, the board need not reach any of the issues that my colleague was talking about at the end relating to claim construction. That only applies in the two Avantail proceedings and need not reach any of the issues that relate to Avantail. Just very briefly on RFC 2401, of course, is a request for comments on a standard proposal by the Internet Engineering Task Force, a well-known standard-setting organization for Internet protocols. That reference has been asserted in a variety of proceedings where Vernetics did not contest its prior art status, including in the ITC, including in re-exams, including in this court, and with good reason. Of course, the whole purpose of a standard-setting document is for the public to be able to use it to facilitate interoperability, as this court has recognized in Kyocera, and a request for comments by its terms invites timely public feedback. The board relied on the indicia of public accessibility in 2401 itself. It relied on the uncontroverted testimony of our expert, who was a person of ordinary skill in the art, who testified as to his basis of familiarity with RFC practices, and it relied on RFC 2026, a corroborating document by the Internet Engineering Task Force that talks about its protocols and procedures.
And there was no evidence to the contrary?
And there was no evidence offered to the contrary, and there's a reason for that, Judge Lurie, because there's really ultimately no question that RFC 2401 was publicly accessible as of November 1998. That is what the declaration, for example, of Ms. Ganoza, which the board admittedly did not rely on, but she was the RFC editor going all the way back to 1999 prior to the critical date. She testified or provided, there's a declaration from her that indicated that it was publicly accessible as of the date on the face of the document, and certainly prior to the critical date. And indeed, you can look at a variety of corroborating things that confirm that, all of which was available to the board, and there was no evidence whatsoever to the contrary. If the court has questions on this issue, of course, I'm happy to address those. But between the document itself, the corroborating RFC 2026.
Why don't you deal with the other six claims?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So let me first turn to the issue that I think that my colleague was most focused on, which was the issue of whether or not the board changed theories with respect to two of the claims. And this affects only two of the claims, claim 4 and 26 of the 8705 patent. The other claims, the claims 14 and 31 of the 8705 and claims 13 and 28 of the 0705 patent, those just require that the target device be a server. The board found that that it would be obvious to a person of ordinary skill in the art that you could use the invention with a server. After all, a server is just a computer that provides content or information to a client device that asks for it. It's a concept that's as old as computing. If you load a web page, that information, when you look on the internet, it's coming from a web server. If you download music or video, it's coming from a server. And as the board observed, Beazer specifically contemplates that the network devices, such as web TV sets, interactive video games, personal computers, and such, they have to get the content from somewhere. That would be obvious. Frenetica's only argument about that is that this is somehow actually an inherency issue, but that argument doesn't really follow, and I didn't really hear my colleague addressing that significantly today. His main focus was on the broadband limitation, which affects, as I said earlier, claims 4 and 26. And the only challenge that they've made to the board's finding that those two claims are obvious is to argue that the board somehow changed theories from institution to the final written decision. But the fact is, nothing changed. We didn't argue inherency. We argued in our petition that RFC 2401 in combination with Beazer rendered those claims obvious, and we relied in our petition on paragraph 80 of Professor Thomasia's declaration to explain why the use of a cable modem on a cable network was a broadband connection. It was Vernetics that argued, well, this was necessarily an inherency argument, and Vernetics that injected the idea that this was about inherency into the case.
They didn't say that you changed theories. They said the board changed theories.
I understand that, Judge Newman, and my point was only to say that what the board ultimately did is exactly what we asked the board to do in our petition. We made the same argument consistently in our petition, in our reply, and it's what the board instituted on the same references, Beazer, RFC 2401, and relying on our arguments about paragraph 80 of Professor Thomasia, and that's what the board relied on in its final written decision. What the board did in its final written decision was walk through the very argument that we had made in our petition, relying on the Beazer disclosure, relying on the reasoning in Professor Thomasia's declaration, paragraph 80, the same thing that we relied on in our petition, the same thing the board relied on at institution. And it walked through it, did its analysis, and concluded, at the end of its analysis, it said, none of this requires inherency. And that's not a change. What Vernetics is really arguing about is semantics. The teaching at issue, the disclosure of using a cable modem with a high-speed cable network, is all in the single reference of Beazer. And at both institution and the final written decision, the board relied on one paragraph in particular, paragraph 80 of Professor Thomasia, regarding what that reference teaches a person of ordinary skill in the art. And whether you label that inherency or not in the context of what is an obviousness determination is ultimately beside the point. This case, I think, is really indistinguishable from the Genzyme case, where the court observed, quote, the board's final written decisions were based on the same combinations of references that were set forth in its institution decisions. And as Genzyme held, quote, there was no requirement for the institution decision to set forth every legal or factual issue that might arise. That's page 1366 of that opinion. And that's exactly what's gone on here. The board relied on the same evidence, the same argument, and it ultimately agreed with our argument and simply, at the end of the day, rejected Vernetics' attempt to characterize that as being an inherency issue. There's certainly no question that Vernetics had notice as of what the issue was, because the arguments that we made and that the board relied on at both stages never changed. And to use an analogy from patent practice, certainly Certainly, the thrust of the argument, if you're thinking about this and analogizing to whether there was a new ground of decision, certainly the thrust of the argument never changed.
Was Beezer cited in the Patent Office? Was it among the 70 columns of references which the applicant presented?
Judge Lurie, I don't know for certain off the top of my head if it was, but I suspect that it was, given the number of references that were identified by the time that these five patents were issued.
But it was buried.
I'm sure that it would have been hard to identify among the many references, but I'm not sure, but I believe it probably was, given the history here. I'm happy to answer questions if the court has them with respect to the remaining issues going to the direct limitation or Aventail. Suffice it to say, I think that the board is certainly entitled to conclude that there was no clear and unambiguous disclaimer when it couldn't get a straight answer from Vernetics as to what was purportedly in and what is purportedly out in terms of direct and indirect limitations. And, of course, the board had before it a more a significant record of the history in these proceedings, including proceedings and re-exams in which Vernetics itself had argued that that it had not done any sort of disclaimer. But as I said at the outset, the court need not reach any of those issues if it agrees with us with respect to the six limitations under Beezer, because if it does, then Aventail is simply beside the point.
On the theory that there was a disclaimer, and that all things considered, it should have been considered. Where does that leave us?
Well, I think
I'm thinking of again. Was the alternative argument presented?
Judge Newman, if you were to think that there had been a disclaimer that should be enforced, despite Vernetics's inability to explain to the board and its inconsistent positions in litigation and in front of the board and in front of the Patent Office. But if you were to think that there were a disclaimer and that the word direct should be read in, first, there is the alternative argument that Aventail itself discloses direct communications. Second, the arguments relying on the Beezer reference, of course, are entirely independent of this. And so with respect to the Beezer reference, if you agree with us with respect to the six claim limitations, then that would be dispositive, and it wouldn't matter what the claim construction was, because the claim construction was not at issue in the proceedings that involved the Beezer reference. Even if you disagreed with respect to the six, it wouldn't matter as to all the other claims that would remain invalidated by Beezer. So they're really, with respect to this direct issue, Judge Newman, there are really two different sets of alternative arguments. The first is that Aventail itself discloses direct communication for the reason that the board explained, that whatever Vernetics may have said to the Patent Office years ago, that has been proved to be inconsistent with its litigating positions and with what it argued was direct communication found to be infringing in the Cisco case. And the board, on the record in front of it, it concluded on that record that Aventail did disclose direct communications. That's one alternative argument. And then the other alternative argument, of course, is that these claims are all invalid under Beezer. And the proceedings that involved Beezer and that invalidated all of these claims under Beezer do not involve this claim construction issue at all. So there are essentially two alternative arguments that do not implicate the alleged disclaimer.
Okay.
If the court has further questions on any of these issues, I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, I'll yield back the balance of my time.
Any questions, Mr. Any further questions? Okay. I think we're all right. Thank you, Mr. O'Quinn.
Thank you, Judge Newman.
Mr. Timofeev.
Judge Newman. On the printed publication, very briefly, with respect to the evidence by Apple's expert, he only testified that he read those, the RFC publications, he discussed them. He never testified that he had familiarity with the publishing process. So there was no testimony from him that he actually knew how the Internet Society Task Force assigned those dates and what the date on the cover meant. RFC 2026, as I already mentioned, does not say anything about the date that appears on the cover of the RFC. And as my colleague mentioned, what's striking is that he emphasizes the evidence that the board said it did not need to consider, the Ginoza evidence. So again, our position is that this court really should not countenance the board shirking the evidentiary requirements if there is indeed this highly probative evidence, as my colleague argues, that the date can be established and the public dissemination as of November 1998 can be established, then this court should remand to the board so it can consider whether that evidence is admissible and whether indeed that evidence is as strong as Apple argued. Turning to the questions of inherency in Dazer, with respect to the question of the server limitation, I think actually that issue is, I spoke about it very briefly only because in our view it's fairly clear. The court only needs to look at what was the supporting evidence before the board that the disclosure of a originating device being a web TV or similar device necessarily means the terminating device must be a server. And that evidence was, it's on appendix page 6675. It's paragraph 289 of a declaration of Apple's expert. And that declaration simply says that the web TVs and similar devices could be used to connect to a server. There was no evidence that indeed those devices would necessarily connect to a server. So the board made an inferential leap that is not supported by the evidence. That is with respect to the argument concerning the server limitation in DESA. With respect to the argument about the broadband, what the reason that Apple actually argued inherency, because if the court looks at, on page, just a second. If the court looks on page J49 in the 810 proceeding, the board itself clearly said that the 705 patent required that there be separate channel in a modulated link in order for the broadband communication to be met. There is no testimony that, in fact, the BESA disclosed those separate channels. If this court looks at appendix 6584, paragraph 80 of Dr. Tomasi's declaration, he only testifies that there were modulated signals in BESA. Therefore, there was no testimony about BESA disclosing the separate channels. That's why the board applied inherency. When the board changed disclaimed inherency, which is what Apple argues, and you can see it on page appendix 1229, Apple argues that used the word necessarily to describe the inherency argument. Once the board disclaimed inherency, there was really no evidence to support the obviousness finding because that obviousness finding depended on inherency. On Avantail, we think, irrespective of the differences in the record, there was a clear disclaimer that Apple itself has described as a clear mandate and that it's successfully enforced. So we think that there is that disclaimer of the very prior at issue in this proceeding should govern. Very quickly to respond to Judge Lurie's earlier question, actually one of the reasons that Vernetics listed 70 references because it included references that Apple and other defendants in a parallel district court infringement proceedings and also in other IPR and reexamination proceedings have raised. So that's one of the reasons for such a large number. Unless there are any other questions, my time expired.
Any questions? Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you. The case is taken under submission.